from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. Coming up this hour, in the past 120 years, California voters have elected just five Democrats as governor, and three of them have been named Brown. First Pat and then Jerry Brown have held the state's top job for a total of 24 years. And a new book traces the history of California as told through their family's history, going all the way back to the Gold Rush. The book by Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Miriam Powell is titled The Browns of California, the Family Dynasty that Transformed a State and Shaped a Nation. She'll join us for the hour right after this news. And welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. Well, this week, Governor Jerry Brown has been hosting thousands of heads of state, governors, mayors, captains of industry, and non-governmental organizations at the Global Climate Summit in San Francisco. And it's just the latest example of a governor named Brown shaping the state and its agenda. Before Jerry, there was Jerry, but there was also Pat Brown, together governors for 24 years. And a new book titled The Browns of California traces their family's impact on the state going all the way back to the Gold Rush. Author Miriam Powell joins us now to talk about it and the Brown family legacy. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What prompted you to write this book? It's coming out, of course, as Jerry Brown is about to leave the stage, at least the current stage that he's on.
Right. Who knows what stage he'll end up on. So what really started me thinking about this family and the way in which it parallels the history of the state was listening to Jerry Brown talk about his great-grandfather, August Schuckman, who was a Prussian immigrant who crossed the plains in 1852 and settled in Northern California on the land where Jerry and his wife Ann have been building their retirement home. And Jerry Brown has been very sort of, some would say, obsessed with tracing his ancestors in the last few years. And I just became very interested in that historical link and the arc in which the family represented.
And what brought August Schuckman, Jerry Brown's great-great-grandfather, to California?
He left, the same thing that brought so many people to California at that point in time, which was the opportunity to carve out a life, to make money, to create a family in a world that was so wide open. It was sort of, you know, post-Gold Rush. California just made this leap from being a frontier to being a state, and it drew so many people from around the world.
What did he do when he got here?
He first drove a stagecoach. He peddled vegetables. He became friends with Johann Sutter, who was also a German immigrant and the founder of, obviously, Sutter's Mill. and he and his son founded Sacramento.
A lot of people got rich, including Mr. Sutter.
Exactly.
Did he?
August Schuckman did pretty well for himself. He was a good businessman. He was shrewd, and he managed to sort of parlay land grants and ranches into more and more land, accumulate more and more land. But what he really wanted was to be an innkeeper, which is what his father had been in Germany. And ultimately, he had a sort of strategically located parcel of land that he swapped with one of the big landowners for a ranch that included the Mountain House. The Mountain House was a prominent inn west of Williams.
It's about
an hour north of Sacramento in Colusa County. At that point in time, it was at the strategic location at a fork in the road where stagecoaches stopped. And, for me, this was a way to learn so much California history that I never knew. So there were inns that were the 5-mile house, the 10-mile house, the 15-mile house, and it was how far you would go so you would know where you had to stop and feed and change the horses.
How long could you go on a stage? How far could you go on a stagecoach?
Well, you just had to keep stopping in order to rest and feed the horses.
Yeah. So Jerry Brown, when you go into his office now, has a picture of August Schuckman and loves to talk about that. He and his wife, Ann, they reclaimed the family homestead and they're building, expanding it and modernizing. What is it, do you think, that has stimulated that reconnection to his ancestors?
So it's interesting. I mean, the land has always been in the family ever since then. Jerry's father, Pat, who sort of scraped together, didn't have the money to buy it when his great uncle died and the land was up for sale, but got some of his rich friends to sort of help form a little bit of a corporation and form shares in order to keep the land in the family. And Jerry never went up there. I think he went up there once with his father in 1961, didn't have much interest in it until, much more recently. And when his father died, he had his mother sign the shares over. So he sort of has had it in the back of his mind for a long time. He and Anne began to go up there in the 90s, and he feels a really strong, I'd say almost spiritual connection to the place. And it means he finds it very meaningful to walk in his grandmother's footsteps. And I think, there's something that Anne said about Cherry at the inauguration, inauguration in 2016.
2017, or no, I'm sorry, 2015, yeah.
Yeah, 2015, right. Where she said that there's no one, she talked about how he had been interested in tracing his family and said that she thought there was no one she knew who looked to the past as much as he did for guidance and for principles.
So it was August Shuckman's daughter, Ida, who got out of Dodge and came down to San Francisco and didn't really look back. What was it about San Francisco, which is where Pat and Jerry Brown were born, what was it about the city that attracted her?
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco plays such a big role in this book for me. It was a great opportunity to learn about this place and its history and its role in California. And, San Francisco at the turn of the century was a very exciting place. It was the Paris of the West. There were all sorts of intellectuals, artists, writers. The Bohemian Club was forming. It was, San Francisco was the heart of the conservation movement, John Muir and so forth. So it was a really vibrant intellectual community. And Ida Shuckman Brown was a very smart, independent woman who was able to just sort of go out and soak all this up and really absorb that world of San Francisco and become, self-educated in many ways.
And like Jerry's mom, his grandmother was a very smart woman.
Very smart and independent thinker in her views about religion and in her views about politics, about equality. She was a very early supporter of civil rights, very much raised her children. And they grew up in the Western Addition. It was a very diverse neighborhood. There was a Jewish orphanage down the street. Pat Brown went to Lowell High School by accident, really, because they lived nearby. It was the closest high school, but he obviously met people there who were drawn to it because it was already such an elite school in the city. And he formed his own fraternity at Lowell because his good friend, who was Jewish, was not allowed into any of the other fraternities. So they formed an ecumenical fraternity, and many of his future friends and financial backers, such as Norton Simon, were his classmates, whom he got to know in part because of his a sort of embrace of people of all races and religions.
And something which, of course, shaped his politics later on.
Very much so.
Talking with Miriam Powell, her new book is called The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and shaped a nation. Pat Brown, born in 1905, just before the earthquake here in San Francisco, was certainly as an adult and as a as a governor, was very gregarious, sort of an old style politician. What was he like as a kid?
He was very much like that as a kid too, and he even looks at there are these wonderful photos in the book which we can't show on the radio, but that I was able to get from one of Jerry's cousins, who was sort of the keeper of the family photo trove. And even as a little kid, Pat Brown has that expression, like, come and vote for me, sort of just like he was a really kind of a ham, and he, loved to be around people from the youngest age.
Did he run for, student government?
He did. And he tells this famous story, which I think is true with Pat Brown stories. You never quite knew because they were a little bit embellished, and unlike his son. And in fact, I had a number of conversations with his son where I said, that story about X, is that true? And he would say, well, this part is, but that part, he kind of, you know, is exaggerated. But at any rate, Pat Brown told the story that he ran for class secretary, which is true, and was elected secretary, that he really wanted to run for president, but there was a big popular football player who was running, and he didn't think he could beat him, so he didn't challenge him, ran for secretary, really did not like being secretary, you know, which was sort of a administrative post as opposed to the front leadership, and that he took from that experience the lesson that you should just go for what you wanted, you know, even if you thought that it was an uphill run.
And San Francisco at that time, although it was certainly kind of a Wild West kind of city, I think, in many ways, it was, and Pat Brown was, a Republican. I mean, there were a lot of Republicans in San Francisco at that
and
time.
And his father was a Republican. As we haven't mentioned, so Ida Brown married Edmund Joseph Brown. I'm sorry, Ida Shuckman married Edmund Joseph Brown, who was an Irish, the son of Irish immigrants from Tipperary, who also came to San Francisco because of the openness and because of that sort of idea that you could be Irish in San Francisco and have opportunities that you were denied back in the East.
And Catholic.
And Catholic, right. Very important. So they were raised as Catholic kids for the most part.
So they're Republican. Pat Brown is Republican. What did that mean?
I lost my train of thought there. But his father was friends with the Republican boss of San Francisco. They had gone to school together. So he was very much sort of, you know, Pat wanting to get into politics just assumed he would be a Republican and that was the way to go. He ran an unsuccessful primary in 1923 for assembly. He was 23 years old, so I'll do my math. 1928, that was his first race. And then he begins to practice law. It's the Depression, and he's very moved by Roosevelt. And like many people at that time, switches his enrollment to be Democratic.
And did that help him or did it really not matter so much?
I think it helped him. It shaped his politics. And obviously, he was very in tune with what the Democratic Party of that time was.
And he went to law school, but he skipped getting an undergraduate degree.
He did, and which was not that uncommon at the time. He could have gone to the University of California at Berkeley. There was no tuition. But it would have also been a really long commute because there was no bridge. So it would have been an all-day kind of affair. And he said always that he didn't go for financial reasons, which was partly true because he did work during the day when he went to night law school and contributed to the family. His father was sort of often won a lot of money, lost a lot of money. So Pat was kind of a help to the family. But he also was a guy in a hurry. And he just saw he didn't need to go to college.
It was 4 years he didn't want to spend in school. Yeah. And did, you know, Jerry Brown, of course, is known for his intellect, curiosity. What about Pat Brown?
He's a sort of different. I mean, he was not an intellectual in the same way. He was very self-conscious about not having gone to college later in life. So he was an avid reader. He always had this overstuffed briefcase that was full of magazines and books that he was reading. And he tried to sort of fill in those gaps. He relied a lot on his wife, really, Bernice, who was this precocious, brilliant girl who went to Cal when she was 15 years old. And she really sort of also sort of backed him up on a lot of things. He was worried sometimes about not knowing how to pronounce words and things that, you know, we take for granted and that people who went to college knew. So there was a certain regret there on his part. But I think, you know, temperamentally, you can so different from his son and not, whereas Jerry will focus on something intensely and want to read everything about it. You know, Pat was always moving on to the next thing.
Well, and the first office he held was district attorney here in San Francisco. And he ran sort of certainly anti-crime, but he also ran on preventing crime and being sort of a what you might call smart on crime. That's what, you know, Kamala Harris sort of embraced when she was district attorney here in San Francisco. You know, sort of progressive, given that it was the 1940s.
Right. A view of the criminal justice system, I think, that was very kind of warm and embracing in some ways, that it was not just for punishment. He's sort of most famous, I mean, he did a lot of things like that where there was a lot of issues about prostitution at the time. He set up a separate sort of court to deal with women and young girls who had, you know, come here, been drawn to San Francisco like so many people, ended up in prostitution because they had no money. He would figure out ways to send them home. He set up health clinics to test for venereal disease. And then he also kind of really saw his role as reaching out to the kids of San Francisco and to sort of try to prevent kids from getting to crime. He published a book that was really popular called Youth Don't Be a Chump, where he kind of encouraged all the girls and boys of San Francisco to come and meet him and talk to him if they had any problems because they had a friend in Pat Brown.
He also, and it might be misremembering, he did this when he was Attorney General, but he went after abortion parlors, illegal abortions.
When he was DA, that's right. Inez Burns was the famous case of the abortion clinic in San Francisco, who she managed to evade prosecution for many years and to pay off. I mean, the other big issue that he faced and ultimately said he was not successful at dealing with was police corruption.
And that was because why? Too ingrained and entrenched
and gambling. Gambling was the other thing that he, there's a great quote from him in a letter where he said that, you know, gambling has been going on in this city long before I was born and it's going to go on long after I die and there's just really nothing I can do about it.
And didn't his father run a gambling den?
Yes, he did. His father ran it was legal to operate a club if it was a private club, but not if it was public. And so Pat's job actually in law school was to sit there so that there was the veneer of you had to, you know, have some, so you have to be a member to be admitted, but really anyone who paid $5 or whatever it was could come in. So
Jerry Brown is born in 1938, before his dad became district attorney, and goes to Catholic schools as a kid, right?
So his first years were at public school until St. Brendan's opened in the neighborhood. He grew up on Magellan Avenue in the Forest Hill neighborhood. And the St. Brendan opened when he was in fourth grade, I think. And so he went there then. His father was a lapsed Catholic for a long time and then went to a Jesuit retreat early 1940s, and sort of came back to the church and decided he wanted to raise his kids as in a religious environment.
And certainly Jerry took to that. He went to St. Ignatius and then ultimately joined the seminary.
Right. He went to St. Ignatius and he then went to Santa Clara. He wanted to go directly into the seminary, but he was too young to go without his parents' approval. They refused to give it, essentially, and were in the hope that he would change his mind.
His mom was not religious really at all, right?
His mom was not Catholic and not religious, and very much so, never really, and was very upset by his decision to enter the seminary.
What attracted him to it?
I think in part that it was a high calling. There were a lot of boys in his class at St. Ignatius who went into the seminary. It was really seen as something that was a way to serve God and country. And we were talking before a little bit about this idea of public service being something that everyone in that family really grew up with, a sense of the importance of that. And being a Jesuit priest was a way to be of service in that sense.
So he really never, at that point, thought about running for office himself?
No, I mean, the first that we know that he really thought about it was when he was in law school, really, you know, once he was out of the seminary. But I think he certainly saw himself as, you know, being a leader in a different, it was in a different realm. And there's also something about the structure that appealed to him. He is, in many ways, you know, somewhat of an unstructured person, but always kind of liked to be in an environment that had that kind of structure. There's a great quote that he gave in a eulogy for his mother when she died, where he says, "She provided the structure that I needed so that I knew I could bounce around and there would always be someone to catch me." And in a way, the Jesuits did that too.
So we all know Jerry Brown, of course, but he also had three sisters, two older and one younger, Kathleen Brown.
Right. So Barbara is the oldest sister. Barbara was a lot like her mother and being super, super smart, great student, went to Cal, was an, on the wrote for the newspaper, was in a sorority with Joan Didion, and, you know, but was born, she was born in 1931, so she grew up in an era where women were going to get married. That's what you did. And maybe you worked as a secretary or a teacher while your husband was in law school or medical school. And Barbara, of all the kids, is the one who wanted nothing to do with politics. You know, hope that people didn't find out that her father was the governor of the state, a very kind of strong, independent woman like her mother and her grandmother. Cynthia was the second sister, who is described by her husband, Joe, as being Pat Brown in skirts.
What does that mean?
Just the same gregarious personality, yeah. And just, you know,
but
really,
she never went into politics.
She did not, but she was a big sort of supporter, and her husband worked on campaigns, and her kids were involved in sort of helping Jerry's campaigns, and her daughter, Pat Brown's oldest granddaughter, Kathleen Kelly, is a judge in San Francisco, also very involved in juvenile justice, like her grandfather had been. And then Kathleen, the youngest, who, of course, had her own political career.
Yeah, became treasurer, reelected, and ran unsuccessfully for governor against Pete Wilson. So Pat Brown becomes governor in 1958. What is happening in California at that time? Because it was seemed to be on the verge of becoming the modern state that we know now.
Yeah. So the war years are so important in the history of California, and such a demarcation line, because, you know, so much of the military comes to California at that time. You have this explosion in the bases and the facilities and the aerospace industry and all of those things. And then I don't remember the numbers, but the millions of military who ship out of San Francisco and see California for the first time and say, this is, man, you know, I'm coming back here. And they do. So after the war, there's a period where there are 1,000 people a day moving to California.
Wow.
And we're in the baby boom years and 1,000 babies being born. So the place is just exploding. The statistics are these great statistics about how many traffic lights a day are getting put up in the state of California.
And Pat Brown really embraced that.
He did. He just, because he was such a California chauvinist also, the idea that California was going to be the first place, the first in the country, and it was going to be his state, and that he could play a role in shaping that was really important to him.
And really was excited when California passed New York State as the most populous
there's a little
state.
Yeah, there's some controversy over when that exactly happened, but he had set up in 1962, he set up a counter over the but by the Golden Gate Bridge that sort of, you know,
tracked the population.
To show when it would pass New York. And he kind of arbitrarily declared that it, you know, happened at the end of 1962, and there was a 3-day celebration of first days, and California was first in everything.
All right. We are coming up on a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Miriam Powell, and her book is called The Browns of California, The Family Dynasty That Transformed a State and Shaped a Nation. We'd love to hear from you. If you have stories about Pat Brown or Jerry Brown, Kathleen, any of them, if you went to school with them, worked for them, remembered them, voted for them, voted against them. We'd love to hear from you. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Or you can send us, a Facebook message, Twitter, @KQED Forum. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Mina Kim, and my guest is Miriam Powell, the award-winning author. Her new book is called The Browns of California, The Family Dynasty That Transformed a State and Shaped a Nation. Pat Brown, Jerry Brown, Kathleen, and going all the way back to August Shuckman, who came during the Gold Rush era in California. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch via Twitter and Facebook. We're @KQED Forum, or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Love to hear from you. If you worked for any of the Brown administrations, went to school maybe with one of the Brown kids, voted for or against Jerry Brown in one of the many elections that he ran in, and we'll get to that in a second. Pat Brown, as we said before the break, gets elected governor in 1958, reelected in 1962, beats Richard Nixon after he had lost to JFK in 1960. And then things turn a little bit south, a lot really, for Pat Brown and for the state. Tell us what's going on after that period of 1963 to his next reelection in 66.
Well, the growth that we were talking about brings with it, of course, a lot of problems. There's a famous quote from Wallace Stegner who says that people found that they were living next door to exactly that which they tried to escape from. So smog becomes a problem, traffic, all of those issues. And race relations become a problem. And Pat is such a champion of civil rights and of fair housing legislation, and really in a way, in a sort of admirable but almost blind spot, cannot see why people would not understand that that was a good thing.
And this was really a time when certainly the electorate was very white.
The electorate was extremely white, and there's lots that's been done about the impact of redlining in all across the state of California and all of the restrictive covenants. So you began to have black communities where they were very isolated, and then you have Watts
in the riots
in Watts in 1965, and here in the Bay Area, the free speech movement at Berkeley and all of the student protests, which become Pat gets very caught up in and handles in ways that I think to some degree he regretted afterwards. But the footage, which is still all over online, of the kids being, you know, carried out of Sproul Hall, Mario Savio, the free speech movement. And that becomes a symbol for people that things are out of control, that Pat Brown does not have control of the state. People want sort of order. And here comes Ronald Reagan, who's the outsider with that, you know, outside appeal that someone has to come and clean up the mess at Berkeley is the slogan that they find has the most resonance with people.
And I want to play a clip, actually, from 1966, the year he was facing Ronald Reagan. And this is a short clip from a speech that he gives to PG&E employees.
What has Ronald Reagan ever done for the state of California in his entire life, other than make a motion picture, Bedtime for Bonzo, or Ladies on Probation, or The Last Stand of Custer? I mean, these are the things. Why, we've been building this great big state of California. It's colleges, and it's universities, and it's freeways. Where was my opponent?
And Miriam Powell, that line of attack didn't really work for Pat Brown.
No, and it's, you know, that clip is from, it was not exactly a debate, but side-by-side appearances that Reagan and Pat Brown gave to the PG&E employees, which parenthetically you can find and see actually, you know, online.
Very interesting.
And Pat Brown at that point, it was late in the campaign. He knew he was losing. He was so defensive. And Reagan gets up and is just so comfortable. He's introduced as the boy next door. He says, you know, my opponent has, you know, never had a job in his life outside of politics. And it just... And Pat Brown just so underestimated Reagan and really kind of never forgave himself for that decision, too, because he just sort of thought this guy's an actor. How can he possibly appeal to people?
Yeah, well, there was that same feeling in 1980, I think, when he was running for president, when Reagan was. And in fact, the other Republican in the primary that year was the mayor of San Francisco,
Correct.
George Christopher, who was Pat Brown's campaign undermined because they thought Reagan would be easier
right.
to beat.
Right. They went out and they really smeared him in by dredging up something as a scandal that wasn't, and went out to try to sabotage his campaign in order to get Reagan as an opponent.
Yeah. Well, careful what you wish for. So he's Jerry Brown begins then to get involved in politics. His dad loses, and he gets elected to a community college board in Los Angeles. And then in 1970, he runs for Secretary of State.
Right.
Why that seat?
Well, and so to back up even a couple of years further, Jerry does this thing where he moves to Los Angeles when he gets out of law school, deliberately takes a job in L.A. because the political power has shifted. I mean, that's another interesting historic trend that is reflected in this family, where Pat Brown is very much a Northern Californian and, you know, runs in and is elected at a time when that was the power base. But by the late 60s, you know, all of that has shifted. So Jerry goes to Los Angeles because he wants to go into politics. He's thinking ahead.
Is he also, in a way, getting away from his father?
I don't think so. I think it was really a very practical decision on his part. He will say now that he spent a long time in Los Angeles, although he, I think, considers San Francisco home, and this is where he was raised, and he was happy to come back here. But he gets involved in 1968 in the anti-war movement, you know, as a delegate and a supporter of Eugene McCarthy, who becomes also kind of an interesting alternate political role model for him. You know, also
alternate to his father.
Yes, you know, an intellectual, a poet, a religious Catholic, and Jerry's very strong on the idea of how wrong the war is and the need to stop it, has a lot of tension with his father over that issue. His father feels that Lyndon Johnson, you know, must know what he's doing. He's so smart about everything else. He's been so committed on civil rights. How could he be wrong on this? And Jerry then looks for some way into elected office. And here along comes the first Los Angeles Community College Board. There are 140 candidates. He puts his name on the ballot, comes in first by overwhelmingly because the name Edmund Gerald Brown is a very familiar one to voters.
Yeah. And we should say also that he is named Edmund, but was never really called that because his mother hated the name.
Yes.
She called him Jerry.
Yes. So he was called Jerry, but, you know, makes a very calculated political decision to run for office as Edmund G. Brown.
And how are they different as politicians, Pat and Jerry?
Their styles are so different, and they were probably, you know, in some ways, each is the right politician for their era. So Jerry is a perfect politician for an era where you are not doing what his father did, which is going out and talking to people one-on-one and doing barnstorming the state. He is into technology. He was an early adapter of cable TV, of raising money with 800 numbers and online. He was an early blogger, really understanding, very shrewd about understanding how to use and the media or the mass media, and you know, very cerebral, obviously. And
really sort of looked down at some of the backslapping and the streamers, the photo ops that his father embraced.
Completely rejected that, both I think for pragmatic reasons, but also for personality ones. You know, he does not like to have his picture taken. He famously refused to give out autographs when he was governor for the first time because he felt that that sort of cheapened
There's a story in the book that he refuses to send a photo of himself to a six-year-old girl, I think, that had written to him.
There's a kid, yeah, I think he's like an 11-year-old kid who's collecting photos and autographs of every governor in the state, and California is the only one he doesn't have, and somehow manages to write to Pat Brown as well. And Pat tries to get Jerry to do it and writes back to the kid and says, you know, I've asked him to do this, but sons don't always listen to their fathers.
Yeah. And Jerry Brown gets elected governor, and it's right sort of he runs as a reformer, as he did when he was Secretary of State, supports campaign finance reform, cleaning up the money in politics. He embraced the Fair Political Practices Commission, which was on the ballot, got created, but almost immediately turns around and runs for president in 1976. Was that just because he was bored already? What prompted him to do that?
It's a year and a little less than a year and a half into his first term. I think there's a quote at the time that one of his closest friends gave that said, if Jerry's running for president, it's because he thinks he can be president. And he did. And he thought he could do a better job as president than anyone else. You know, it was a very heady time. He's the first politician of sort of his generation, that post-Watergate generation, to get elected to a high office. There's a great profile of him that Tom Hayden did for Rolling Stone magazine in 1975 when he first got elected. It's, again, sort of, you know, in terms of the man and the times, it's the post-Watergate years. Another important California politician has just gone down in flames. So there's that sense that young people can do things. And coming out of the student movement, coming out of the anti-war years, and he, you know, has later said that it was a little brash to run at that point in time.
And he did it again and again in 1980 and 92.
He did do it, yeah. So 92 is a little bit different, but he did do it again in 1980.
You know, still governor at that point.
Still as governor and much less successfully the second time.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. We're talking with Miriam Powell. Her new book is called The Browns of California. And we start with Rob in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you. I was just always curious about what Jerry Brown is like off camera, because he always comes across as being this very, very intelligent, very cerebral, but lacking any kind of personal warmth. He never smiles much. He never jokes. He doesn't look like he really has much of a sense of humor. And that, for a politician, he just doesn't have that kind of a charisma that it sounds like his dad had. What's Brown, you know, Jerry Brown, like more behind the scenes?
Miriam?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's, again, says a lot about California that someone with that personality that you're describing can be as successful in California as he has been. He is obviously a very shrewd politician, and because we don't necessarily want warm and fuzzy, you know, elected officials. We want people who are competent. I think he has a great sense of humor. I find him very funny. It's a very dry sense of humor. And he is, you know, in many ways very introverted, like his mother. He's always been compared more to his mother than his father. He is a very private person. He has a lot of very close friends. He is still friends with the kids that he grew up with on Magellan Avenue. They have birthday parties every year. He goes to his high school class lunches, you know, from St. Ignatius every month. So I think he has a, you know, a very sort of rich private life, but in it, he's very private about it. He does not, you know, like for people to come up and take his picture or take selfies. And what he will say is, wouldn't you rather just have a conversation? Isn't that better than, you know, why do you want to memorialize this moment with a photo?
Not a hugger.
No.
Not in public anyway. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Jenny in San Mateo, welcome.
Yeah, hi. I just have a little anecdote about my uncle Joe Hodling, was very active in BCDC in San Francisco. And he used to tell the family, and by the way, my mother was a Republican, so we always had some pretty interesting table talk. But
let me just say, BCDC, Bay Area Conservation and Development Corporation or Commission?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Commission,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so Joe would say, I was the youngest person in Pat Brown's administration and the oldest person in Jerry Brown's administration. And we would all laugh and be proud that he had served both Browns.
Your uncle is in the book.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, because there's some great correspondence between him and Pat Brown. And also, he did a really wonderful oral history. I mean, there's a lot of the book is drawn from documents and archives at the Bancroft Library. And your uncle did a really terrific oral history. And he tells a great anecdote about helping in Jerry's 1974 campaign and being in a bar in Palo Alto. And your uncle is one of the few people from the Pat Brown sort of group who made that transition. There were not a lot of them. So I was very interested in him. And he tells this story about being in a bar in Palo Alto during the campaign. And Jerry says to him, like, why are you supporting me? Because it was a very hotly contested primary with three much better established Democrats running. And he says, first of all, I know your father and I like your father. You know, second, I like what you stand for. And third, you're going to win.
Very practical.
And Jerry made him finance chairman for Northern California.
Jenny, thanks so much for that memory. And Jerry Brown, as governor, surrounded himself the first time, especially with a lot of interesting minds, people he found to be stimulating, but creative thinkers, but who didn't necessarily know the issues and the policies around agencies that he put them in charge of, right?
Right. And he did that very deliberately because he wanted to shake things up. So being an outsider was an advantage. And particularly if you look at the world of in the environmental realm, for example, where he brought people in and put them in charge of agencies that they had, as advocates, been attacking before. So it was in
sounds
it
like
was,
President Trump a little bit.
Yes, in the reverse, but, you know, empowering people to try to make government do some of the things that they had been pressuring it to do from the outside.
They had Pat Brown and Jerry Brown, I would say, I think it's fair to say, a complicated relationship. They were very different people. That relationship, I think, evolved as time went by. But how would you describe that father-son relationship?
You know, again, sort of from talking to people who knew them for a long time and who grew up with Jerry and so knew Pat as, you know, Jerry's dad, I think that sense from them and those who've known him the longest is that it was, in many ways, a really typical father-son relationship. I mean, what father and son don't have complicated relationships, and particularly if you're going into the same line of work. So they had this sort of common core beliefs in a lot of ways, and yet were so different in personality and in some ways in philosophy.
We were talking a moment ago about Jerry Brown not being a particularly effusive or emotional person in public. And I want to play a clip. We mentioned that he had run for president in 1992 against Bill Clinton. And here he is speaking at the Democratic National Convention about his father.
And I want to thank one other person and is missing his first convention since the Depression, a man who beat Richard Nixon in 1962 and almost stopped Ronald Reagan in 1966, and in my view is the greatest Democrat in this country, my father, Pat Brown. Dad, thanks a lot for everything you've done.
And it's easier if you're watching that video, but he gets quite choked up talking about
his father. He does. It's a really emotional moment. People who were there sort of still get choked up talking about it because it was such a public tribute to his father, who was at that point in very poor health and, you know, not able for the first time to come out and campaign for his son. And so, you know, a very moving tribute, I think.
His dad dies a few years later, and there's an anecdote in the book which is hilarious. I mean, Jerry Brown is known for being, as he says, tight with a buck or, you know, frugal.
Cheap is the
cheap
word he uses.
And so you say that Pat Brown dies. Kathleen Brown gets to the family home first and picks out the least expensive casket she could find in the catalog, and then Jerry arrives and finds one that's cheaper.
Right, that is because there's a plain pine coffin with a Jewish star on it, which is cheaper. And
so the Irish Catholic guy gets buried in the
Jewish
pine box
home,
with it, yeah.
Which I think Pat would have really liked because he believed in that kind of ecumenical.
Yeah. Embracing all religions. Yeah. There you go. Let's go back to the phones. And Mary in San Francisco, you're next.
Hi. Oh, thanks so much. Very interesting. I grew up in the edge of the Western Addition, and I'm really curious, where was the Brown household when it was there?
It was at 1572 Grove.
In the Western Addition?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it still there?
The house is still there. What Ida, the practical smart one in the family, took the money that her husband made gambling and invested it in the construction of this three-story building. It had three apartments on three different floors. And so they lived in one floor and rented out the other two, which gave them kind of a steady source of income when Edmund's businesses, you know, failed as they did periodically.
And wasn't one of the tenants Jewish?
Yes, the tenants were Jewish, and the Brown kids, Pat and his brother, would be the Shabbos goys, as we say, who would go and turn on the lights on Shabbos. So, yeah.
Interesting. Thanks very much for that. So do you live near that house, Mary?
We moved out. It became really quite rough. It was quite genteel. This was post-World War II days, and the neighborhood changed. But it was very genteel, and there were several Jewish bakeries and shops on McAllister Street. So it's interesting to see the changes. I'm going to walk by 1572 Grove. We used to walk over there. There was a great deli over there.
Yeah, all right. Mary, thanks so much for the call. Here's a comment from a listener. Angela writes, I remember that in Jerry Brown's first administration, integration in upper levels of state government happened. My uncle, Leonard Grimes, became the first African-American to lead the Public Utilities Commission, and her dad became deputy state architect, very much part of what he did as governor back in the 70s and early 80s.
I think it's a really significant and kind of underappreciated aspect of his first terms where he did come in and shake up in those ways the administration of state government, in both in the executive branch and in the judiciary, which was overwhelmingly white male. Another, you know, California, I try to convey in this book the size of California, because I think that people who don't live here don't really appreciate it. There are more state. There were then three times as many state judges in California as the entire federal system. And he appointed lots of women and minorities to those jobs.
And, of course, he's doing that again this second time as governor. You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Miriam Powell. Her book is called The Browns of California, The Family Dynasty That Transformed a State and Shaped a Nation. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And we'll go back to the phones. Timothy in San Jose, welcome.
Yes, Ms. Powell, did you ever get a chance to read the book Swift Justice, Murder, and Vengeance in a California Town by the author Harry Farrell? It involves one of the best places I've liked to visit. That's St. James Park. There was a double lynching back in
the
1930s.
Let's give her a chance to, I'm not sure that, have you read that book, Miriam, by chance?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Do you have a question, Timothy?
Yes, the so-called, I guess, center of the lynching, the double lynching in St. James Park was the Hart family, the wealthy Hart family of Santa Clara. The Santa Clara University, they were they received that Louis B. Mayer, the MGM studio gift. The powerful interest there was Pat Brown conversant, and did he get any kind of fund support in his political career from the Hart family?
Okay, let's give Miriam a chance.
Louis B. Mayer family.
Okay, yeah.
Question. Yeah, I know the case that you're talking about. I don't know whether he specifically got any support from that family. One of the interesting things, though, about his early support was that so much of it came from Republicans. And that was kind of a reflection also of a very different era and a bipartisan spirit. He was close friends with Earl Warren, who was governor when Pat Brown was first attorney general. You mentioned George Christopher. They were personal friends. Evel Younger was a friend.
And Jerry Brown benefited from that.
Absolutely. And then a lot of the early money that supported Pat and his campaigns came from Republicans like Norton Simon.
Here's a comment from Joe, who writes, I thank Pat Brown for my affordable public education. I attended a great college prep, public elementary school. Then I could easily afford UC Berkeley, and I thank him dearly for his goal to make higher ed affordable. And that was really a very big part of his legacy.
Enormous part of his legacy. And for me, writing the book, the University of California, particularly the Berkeley campus, is almost a character in the book because it takes It spans so much of the legacy of the Browns. Bernice went there. Many of their children, grandchildren, nephews, and nieces went there. Pat Brown, who skipped college, called it my university. He felt such an attachment. He and his wife ended up giving $1 million to Cal. And
ironically, Jerry does not have such a great relationship with UC.
Right. He does not.
Even though he did go there.
He did go there. But and then just a little thing that people may not know, or people may of a certain age don't know, and that is that Pat's connection to the master plan. I mean, he was really the person who pushed through the master plan, which Clark Kerr was the architect of, that set up this three-part system and the relationships between the community colleges, the state colleges, and universities. You know, no state in the country has anything remotely like that. And three university campuses in San Diego, Santa Cruz, and Irvine were started from scratch under Pat Brown and built, which, you know, no new university opened until the university in Merced relatively recently.
Yeah. So here's another comment from Gerald, who writes, in 1978, after seeing Governor Brown's sharp 180 turn with respect to Prop 13, I understood that he was a political shark for whom the Governor Moonbeam nickname provided some useful cover. This is not at all purely criticism. A shark on your side can be very useful. He took a while to come out against Prop 13, and then when it passed, he was like a born-again tax cutter.
They called him Jerry Jarvis for a while. And in fact, Howard Jarvis filmed a commercial for Jerry when he was running for re-election in 1978. He did. His father was actually very upset about that because he viewed Prop 13 as, you know, such an attack on the system that he had presided over. But that's the pragmatic side of Jerry Brown. Once it's the law, you've got to do it, and you got to get reelected, and that's the way to do it.
Yeah, we're very short on time. We haven't really talked about his second stint as governor, but he's had the chance to fix some things that he feels he broke, in particular the criminal justice system.
Right. There's a great quote from him where he said, it's a very classic Jerry Brown quote, "I helped screw things up, and now I'm going to help unscrew them." He has had a lot of change of heart about criminal justice, sort of embracing his father's idea of the rehabilitative, restorative justice.
Before we go, I want to read a comment from Patricia Kelly Carlin, who is Pat Brown's second favorite granddaughter. She says, "I'd like to share a couple of grandpa-isms. One quote, there is no disputing tastes. This was central to much of his tolerant, compassionate perspective. Someone had the gall of a canal horse. We were all his second favorites." FYI, he was a great grandfather, generous and very loving.
He did. That was a classic Pat Brown. Everyone was his second favorite.
All right. Well, the end of the Brown story, still to come.
Still to be written.
He's got a few more months in office, and then we'll see what comes next. Probably something having to do with the environment. That'd be my guess.
Good guess.
All right. Miriam Powell, again, the book is called The Browns of California. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Highly recommend the book. Lots of great anecdotes. History, I learned a lot. Thought I knew everything about California political history. Not so. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.